This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. Today, we're going to start our show talking about one of the options for education during a pandemic, and that is homeschooling. We're going to talk about it with Teresa Deckert. She's the office administrator for the North Dakota Homeschool Association. Thank you for joining us, Teresa.
Thank you for having me.
What is the mission of your association?
Well, our mission is to bring homeschooling to families in North Dakota to answer their questions and to kind of help point them in the right direction for homeschooling and, you know, make them aware of the legal responsibilities when they homeschool as well.
We'll be talking about a lot of that. How is the organization funded? It's a nonprofit.
Yes, we're a nonprofit, so donations. We do have a membership, but we certainly help people no matter if they're a member or not. And then we do an annual convention, which pretty much supports, you know, doing the convention work. So,
do you have any sense of how many students are homeschooled that are kind of covered by your association, or for that matter, how many might be homeschooled in the state of North Dakota?
Sure. I just want to clarify, they wouldn't be covered by our organization because we are just kind of an organization that walks along beside. The state was given, the North Dakota Department of Instruction, I should say, was given the task of compiling those numbers by the legislature a number of years ago. And so they compile for all children between the ages of 7 and 16, which is our compulsory attendance age. And I believe the 2018 numbers were about 3,400 students in those ages.
And how did you get started in this? You were homeschooling your kids, weren't you?
Yes. Yeah, I homeschooled for 33 years. Just graduated my last one last year. And he's kind of a tag along. I'll let you in on that. But I had heard about homeschooling. I listened to a radio broadcast actually back in 1980, and it was before I even had children. And it just really appealed to me. And so I started learning and researching, and then once I had children, obviously started looking into it, you know, more seriously, and began kind of thinking, well, we'll try 1 year of kindergarten, you know, you're not going to go too wrong with that. But I just honestly can say I fell in love with homeschooling and just the adventure of teaching and learning alongside my kids was just something that I just couldn't imagine not having.
Were you interested in teaching before you were teaching your own kids?
Honestly, I had been. As a young person, I had thought about teaching, and I'm very kind of science, math oriented, and in those days, there was just a lot of pressure to kind of go into those sorts of fields. So I was actually discouraged by my teachers at high school level from going into teaching, and it's kind of sad because I think I missed out on something.
Are there principal reasons for homeschooling? What made you want to homeschool, and what did people typically say prompts them to look into this option?
The reasons are pretty varied. I would say in the early days when I began, and I will add it was illegal at the time in North Dakota, but in the early days, I think most families, it was because they wanted to provide religious education, and they maybe lived in a rural part of the state that didn't have access to private schools. And that was a lot of my motivation. Another part of my motivation was my brother's brilliant young men were just really bored with school, and so they didn't do well. And so I just wanted something different for my kids. I thought if I had more of a handle on it, I could make sure that they were really excelling and mastering subjects, and maybe help guide them a little bit more. A lot of families nowadays choose to homeschool because of bullying, that's one of the number one issues I hear in the office.
Has the pandemic significantly increased interest in homeschooling?
Hugely. It's my emails and phone calls I just cannot keep up with hardly. I've been putting in 10 to or 12 to 14 hour days the last 3 weeks, and our association decided to go around the state doing meetings mostly to give people information in their own communities. And I've done a Facebook Live video as well, which has really had a lot of views and interest, over 3,000 views on that video already.
So you've been holding meetings around the state, and the response has been positive. Can you get a sense of how widespread this interest is?
Oh, pretty widespread. We've kind of kept track of how many families have initially been at the meetings total, and we're right around 1,000 families. A lot of families are just looking for information right now so that they can make the best decision for their families. I mean, there's a lot of concern about the virus, the kids, you know, maybe starting out face-to-face and transitioning to online. And I see with that especially a concern with families with younger children. Also concern about the extra use of cleaning products and chemicals in school settings, and we certainly understand why, but just parents with young children are concerned about that. So I would say that's the main thing I'm seeing, but also I've noticed a lot of families who have considered homeschooling in the past, this is what I'm hearing, and they've just been a little bit afraid to attempt it, but then having their kids home in the spring just help them to see that they probably really can do this. So I think we'll see a growth in long-term home education as well.
The North Dakota Homeschool Association has a statement of faith on the website, and people can go there, visit that website, and get lots of information at ndhsa.org. But is that a requirement? Do you help people regardless of their religious intentions? What responsibility do they have to the organization's faith core?
Really, the only ones that ever have to sign a statement of intent are our board members. We help people regardless of, you know, their faith base. In fact, when I've gone to the meetings, the handouts that I give out, I list a number of different teaching methods, and then I list several curriculum examples, and I list them according to if they're Catholic or Protestant or secular. So we want to help all families. We are a Christian organization, but certainly reach out and support and help any homeschool family in the state.
Well, let's deal with some of the laws around homeschooling and the requirements that parents who are looking into this are going to have to be observant of. Is there a deadline for notifying a school district of your intent to homeschool?
Not really. The law just states that they have to file 14 days before they begin homeschooling. So if they're not going to start until, let's say, the second week of September, technically there wouldn't be a deadline before school. However, because of, you know, the kind of chaotic nature of things right now, we are encouraging families to file that statement of intent before their local district begins this fall. We just think it's a courtesy to districts, and it will just help make the district's job a little bit easier as well.
Does the statement of intent just tell the district that they'll have one less head in class, or is there another relationship that's there? Is there an oversight relationship that the district has with a parent who homeschools?
The statement of intent is exactly that. It is telling the school, my intent is I am going to be taking over the education of my child. That said, it is also signing a document that would have legal ramifications stating that you're taking that responsibility. So it doesn't mean that, you know, I'm pulling them out and I'm not going to do anything. You know, you're signing a legal document saying that you are going to take over the education of your children. And we do have certain requirements and laws for that. But no, the public schools do not have any oversight then. Unless the parent chooses not to opt out of testing, then they can test through the school, and then the school would would administer that test.
Teresa Deckard is the office administrator for the North Dakota Homeschool Association. Teresa, you've done this. You've done this for a long time, and you're dealing with parents who want to do it. What do you tell them about the kinds of responsibilities they're assuming or will assume?
Well, we make them aware of the parental qualifications, which is having a high school diploma or GED, you know, filing the statement of intent with their local district, along with proof of identity of their child and immunization records, and then the proof of how they qualify. They must do 175 days of instruction for 4 hours a day, so I make sure they know that, and then teach the subjects that are in accordance to North Dakota Century Code. They also want to do that. Homeschoolers are supposed to keep a file or a record of what they do. It's not really defined in state law, so I have kind of developed my suggestions for families. And then I've made a few extra suggestions for those who are just homeschooling this 1 year because of COVID concerns.
Are there different ways to do this? Are there different options for homeschooling?
As far as curriculum choices and things like that, yes, there's a lot of curriculum choices. But a parent can also choose to go with an online academy, or they can just they can get a whole, what we would call a boxed curriculum where, you know, everything kind of comes together. Or they can pick and choose from different homeschool providers. You know, let's say they want this history curriculum and they want that science curriculum. All of those are different ways that they could go about schooling their children.
Now, during the pandemic, we're hearing a lot of parents are looking at various options, including kind of coming together as small groups. Maybe there would be 5 or 10 kids and hiring a teacher. Can homeschoolers do that? Can they hire a teacher? Obviously, that's a significant expense. Or is there a teacher monitor relationship that can be arranged for those people who are just getting started?
Sure. You know, that has been a hard question. Up until last legislative session in North Dakota, the parent had that signed the statement of intent had to do all of the instruction. And this last legislative session, we actually got a change in the law that defines the word supervise. And part of the reason for that was to open up for parents to use, let's say, an online academy or to use a tutor, like maybe for math or something like that. But our understanding of home education in North Dakota isn't where you go hire somebody to do all of it. By definition, supervise, this is from the home education statute. Supervised means the selection of materials, determination of an educational philosophy, and oversight of the method, manner, and delivery of instruction. So the parents have a lot of responsibility, you know, in choosing those materials and paying for them. I would say in, you know, determining progress that's being made. So to me, the idea of a neighborhood going together and hiring a teacher is really a small private school. And so our advice to those families has been that they should probably look at setting up a private school rather than trying to do that under homeschool law.
Is there any additional cost to homeschooling?
The costs are just going to be according to, you know, what materials you purchase, you know, and you can go for an online academy and pay up to $2,000 to $3,000 for a student, or you can just pick and choose curriculum from different providers, or buy used curriculum. There's a lot of free resources online, so it doesn't have to be expensive, but it can be if you choose to go with an online accredited academy.
Is there any way to have a curriculum, a kind of connection with your school district? Can you use their materials?
That depends on the school district. North Dakota law does not specifically address that. The district that I'm in, the school will let you use textbooks from the school. You just have to put, you know, a a fee down, you know, to make sure you take care of the textbooks, and then you would return them again then the next at the end of the year. My one caution on that is those textbooks don't come with an answer key, so it will be, you know, more work on the parents' part in that regard.
This 4 hours required instruction per day, does that mean that if both parents are working, we can do this from 7 to 11?
Absolutely. Yes, it doesn't. There's nothing in state law that says when those hours have to occur. If a couple of hours in the morning work best for the family, and then the children are with grandparents or something during the day, and they could be doing reading and some independent work, certainly. And then in the evening, they come together and work again with parents. Absolutely, that is fine. But some of that independent work would also go towards those 4 hours a day, even if the parent isn't necessarily hanging over their shoulder while they're doing it. You know, it could be with a care provider there, you know, and then just when parents get home, then there's some evaluation as to what is done, and maybe some more instruction time going on with parents.
Do many single parents do this?
There are a few single parents that homeschool, yes. Several of those I know use an online curriculum then, and so it is probably less intensive work by the parent, you know, when there's an online program. But yeah, there are some.
Again, getting back to your experience, I'm trying to imagine you with your children. I don't know how many you would have had at one time, but are you literally there with them for 4 hours and occasionally calling them up to what would be a blackboard or some other instructional tool to demonstrate their, you know, capabilities?
You know, when I started, that's what my homeschool looked like, because, you know, the paradigm I knew was a public school classroom, and so that we actually had our little classroom and our blackboard and everything. And over the years, I learned to relax a lot more. My youngest, who I feel in some ways had a better education because mom was less uptight about things, we actually sat on the couch a lot and, you know, read together and discussed, lots of discussion with homeschooling, you know, perhaps had an educational video. We went through the U.S. Constitution with a course that was all on video, and I wanted to get in on it as well. You know, it was done by a constitutional lawyer, and so we would watch the video, and then we'd pause it, and we'd discuss for a while, and then there, you know, he'd have his work to do later on, you know, questions or maybe papers to write or something to research. But yeah, so my schooling changed over the years. It doesn't have to look like a schoolroom, and it probably is more effective if it doesn't.
Good teachers are good students, too. Were you learning alongside your kids?
Absolutely. I'm a little bit appalled at my learning level when I graduated from high school, and I was a good student. But, you know, I look at how much better I know things now, and things that I had missed that I didn't even know I'd missed. Like, I didn't know how to diagram a sentence until I was teaching my own children. I never got it in school, and I thought, you know, it's kind of handy to know how to do that at least.
Teresa Deckard is with the North Dakota Homeschool Association. Teresa, how are assessments made? There are standard tests at various levels of education in public school. Do you have to apply those to your kids?
Well, the one thing I would say with home education is assessment is constantly taking place, because you're more working one-on-one with a child, and you know if they get it or not. And homeschooling is more based on mastery learning. You don't move ahead until your children have, you know, mastered the concept. Standardized tests, achievement tests are mandated by North Dakota law in grades 4, 6, 8, and 10. They must be administered by a North Dakota certified teacher, either in the child's learning environment or the public school. But parents can opt out if they're certified, have a bachelor's, or have a religious, philosophical, or moral objection to testing. My advice usually is to parents to opt out, because then they can get one of those same tests themselves and administer it to their child themselves, because it's the parent that really needs the test to assess how the child is doing. And I've sat in on a couple seminars given by test companies, and they say that the child, you'll get a more accurate result if the child is in their learning environment and tested by someone they're familiar with. So I think we get a better score, not a better score, a better evaluation when the parent actually gives the test. And they're very easy to administer. You know, it tells you everything to read and do and say, and then you set the timer. And so those are the sorts of assessments that take place. And a lot of curriculum will have quizzes and tests as well.
Public education also has this socialization process that takes place. So how is that compensated for in a homeschooling environment?
I'm always surprised that question still comes up after all these years, because homeschool children tend to be very well socialized. Lots of families are involved in church activities, 4-H, things like that. But we also have state support groups, you know, all throughout North Dakota. And like the area I'm in, we meet weekly, and we have an enrichment group, and we do physical education activities together. We have a homeschool choir. We've done plays. We have a lady that writes for the newspaper who has done book club with the kids, and we've had a homeschool newspaper. So there's many, many opportunities for socialization. And homeschoolers don't, we tend to think of socialization in a little bit different way. Not that it means being just with your peer group, you know, kids your own age, but it's way more expansive than that. You know, going to nursing homes, adopting a grandma there, taking care of younger children, all of these things are socialization, and probably more real world type of socialization.
Do homeschool students take an exam to graduate from high school? And how do these students do in post-high school education?
The parent determines the requirements for graduation, and they would decide that unless the student was in some sort of an online academy. I would say in North Dakota, the bulk of homeschooled students go on to college, so we would take our ACT scores just like anybody else. And I think colleges have probably weighted the ACT score a little bit higher for homeschoolers. You know, our office does help families put together a transcript. There are transcript services available as well. But homeschooled students do very well in college. I mean, my children have gone all the way up through masters. Not all of them, but one has a master's degree and has taught at college level herself. You know, homeschoolers tend to be entrepreneurial as well. So one of my boys started his own business. He just did 1 year of college, and then he started his own business, has a very successful business.
It sounds like you've had a successful experience with it, and you want to share this information. Teresa Deckert is the office administrator for the North Dakota Homeschool Association. Again, that website is ndhsa.org. Teresa, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, Harvest Public Media looks at solar power on the farm, and we'll preview a new Frontline film titled Love, Life, and the Virus. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. An interim legislative committee has endorsed the state's Office of Management and Budget's plans to ask for money to make the state capitol compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act. The figure will be up to $750,000. Of that number, $461,000 goes directly toward ADA compliance, and the other money will be for other upgrades, including two family bathrooms, one on the main floor and one near the top of the Capitol Tower. State Facilities Management Director John Boyle told the Interim Government Administration Committee.
We had an incident during the last legislative session where there was an individual who had somebody who assisted them who was of the opposite sex, so they couldn't determine which restroom to use. So if we had a family restroom, that'll solve that issue.
Boyle also told the committee the estimate for ADA compliance came in much less than he expected.
When we met earlier, we thought it'd be far exceed millions of dollars, and we'd have to do it over multiple bienniums. But with the $750,000 number to take care of everything that needs to be done It just seems a lot more reasonable.
The items for ADA compliance include wider doors, signage, sound systems for the hearing impaired, and wheelchair lifts. The committee also approved its own bill draft for the proposal with an emergency clause that, if passed, would allow spending right away rather than waiting until July 1st. And North Dakota State Facilities Director says the project to redo the south side public entrance to the Capitol building will be completed by December 1st. John Boyle told the legislature's Interim Government Administration Committee the project is on schedule. He said as crews were digging, they found something unexpected, a fuel tank that had to be replaced.
So we thought now would be the best time to do it. So we have pulled it out of the ground, and first we drained the fuel out of it and then pulled it out of the ground. We thought that it was leaking. But now that it's gone, there is no contaminated soil or anything, which is wonderful. So that saved us a little bit of money.
Boyle also says the public parking lot on the south side of the building will also have more handicapped parking places. He also told the committee that some CARES Act money is being used for some improvements to the bathroom fixtures.
So everything's going to be touchless. So, you know, you wash your hands, the soap. We did keep paper towels because people like to use the paper towels to hold the handle when they come out, and then they throw the paper towel away. So we have made those accommodations.
Boyle said everything should be ready for the legislature's December organizational session. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
On American Experience.
They were running the biggest deficits in history, pouring a stimulus into the economy.
What I'm describing now is a plan and a hope for the long term. The march of freedom and democracy, which will leave Marxism-Leninism on the ash heap of history.
I thought he could possibly press the button.
The conclusion of Reagan on American Experience.
Watch American Experience tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A U.S. Department of Agriculture program that gives grants to farmers to add solar power to their operations is getting a lot of interest. In some Midwestern states, applications are up 50%. Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports it's a trend that may continue even without the government's help.
Chris Bohr's farm in central Missouri includes hundreds of acres of soybeans and corn. It also includes a 5,000-head hog barn. The barn uses a lot of electricity. It usually costs Bohr more than $15,000 a year to run the ventilation system, cooling fans, and lights. But for the past 2 years, that cost has been under $5,000, thanks to three rows of solar panels that sit about 50 yards away from the barn.
These systems are pretty well maintenance-free. Everything is monitored by computers. We have apps on our phones where we can actually look at the amount of electric that's being produced on an hourly basis, as far as that goes.
Bohr applied for the USDA grant that paid for 20% of the $87,000 cost of the panels. He says they will have paid for themselves in 7 years, and after that, it's pure savings. And while Bohr says the bottom line was the biggest factor in adding the solar panels, there are other reasons.
And, you know, if we can do projects like this to help our environment, to save our natural resources and take advantage of something that God gives us every day, like the sun, then we need to take advantage of it.
Bohr also works closely with his electric co-op. In the sunny summer months, when the solar panels produce more electricity than the hog barn needs, he sells power back to the co-op. Jan Ahler is the director of energy solutions with the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association. He says rural co-ops understand their role in helping farmers be successful.
And they're also able to diversify their revenue streams, right? So they don't only have income coming in from their agricultural production, but they also have money saved from the production of solar electricity.
The USDA's Rural Energy for America program, or REAP, has $250 million available for renewable energy. They fund small projects where the farmer has to pay at least 75% of the total cost. Nathan Tutt oversees REAP in Missouri. He says even though the program funds a variety of energy programs, the falling costs of solar panels has had an effect on the kinds of applications they see.
Over 80% of our applications the past few years have been solar-related. The economics of the industry, with it becoming more palatable for people to implement that system into their operations.
Tut says there's enough money in the program to fund all but a handful of applications, but that could change if the popularity continues to grow. But even without the grants, the falling price of solar panels is making it a viable option. Chris Bohr says farmers are the right kind of people to be innovative and sensible at the same time.
You know, a lot of people today don't understand agriculture. We're very common sense thinkers. We think about what's practical for our operation day in, day out, and what's right for our communities.
Bohr says he's in the planning stages of adding solar panels to another hog barn he owns on a different farm, and that it makes economic sense even without any grant money. The USDA's REAP program is funded at its current level through 2023. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative that looks at farm and rural issues. You can follow the coverage at harvestpublicmedia.org. Next on Main Street, one person's pandemic experience.
The Greater North Dakota Chamber's 9th Annual Policy Summit will be hosted virtually online this year from August 25th through the 27th. This series of five crucial conversations facing North Dakota today include reigniting the economy, occupational licensure, North Dakota's future energy plans, the path for North Dakota's hospitality industry, and crisis leadership moderated by Governor Doug Burgum. Registration for the Greater North Dakota Chamber's Policy Summit is available online now for individual sessions or for the entire series at ndchamber.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Tonight on our television service, we'll offer a new frontline film that takes a deeply personal look at the pandemic. Since the outbreak of the novel coronavirus, we've followed the numbers, infection rates, hospital capacities, and deaths. Frontline's Love, Life, and the Virus focuses on one mother's fight to survive COVID-19 to see her newborn baby. Oscar Guerra is the producer. He recently visited with Lori Walsh, host of In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's my pleasure.
It's a beautiful film. You are a filmmaker, and there's no narration to this. It's just really compelling as you come along emotionally with this family. Tell me a little bit about what kind of stories you look for as a filmmaker that pull you into the story and that you know are going to have the same impact on viewers.
I think that it's the way in which this story is unique is that, you know, we've heard so many terrible news about the hard reality that we're going through. And this film tells you, you know, what can happen when the community starts working together. You know, what can we do to help each other? And it's almost like a case study. What happens when different community partners start working with each other, you start supporting, and, you know, miracles can happen. I think this is a story that brings hope, love, and also an exploration of the reality for many working-class Latino families.
Yeah. Tell me how you met this family and how you were able to follow them along through this really dangerous, the contagion, and
right.
how did you kind of make this film and get the access that you did?
Right. I'm a professor. I'm a filmmaker, but I'm also a professor. I teach film and video at the University of Connecticut. Me and my family, we just recently moved to Stamford, Connecticut from San Francisco. So we've been here in the area for not even a year. Everything started happening, you know, during the peak of the pandemic. My wife, she's a critical care nurse, and she works at Stanford Hospital. So it was a very rough time for us as a family. It wasn't easy for my wife. I think that part of the story became of the inspiration about what she was telling me, you know, when she would come back from work. We have a 2-year-old daughter. She was scared just to hug her daughter, just to kiss her. And I said, I need to start documenting this one way or another. It wasn't easy to be outside, like you accurately mentioned. You know, you needed to be very, very careful with the, you know, going out there. I decided to get in touch with photojournalist John Moore, who works for Getty Images. I didn't know him, but I knew that he was a local. He lived here in Stamford as well. And I told him, hey, listen, I sent him an Instagram message because my wife insisted so much. And I said, okay, I'm going to send him the message so you see that he's not going to respond. And he did. You know, I introduced myself. I said, I'm a
I'm a professor at UConn. I'm a filmmaker, and I would love to start, you know, collaborating with you. Let's see if we can start covering. I would love to cover what you're doing. And he told me, yeah, that's great. Let's talk more about this. And it was because of my wife that we were able to get access to a hospital. As you can imagine, going to with cameras to a hospital is not easy. And going to a hospital with cameras in the middle of a pandemic, it was very, very challenging. It took us almost a month to be able to get all the permits, all the safety requirements. You know, the hospital was very thorough, but they were willing to collaborate. And Catalina Horak from Building One Community told John about this family. She said, you know what, I think that there might be an interesting story here, and we're not sure what's going to happen, but if you get a chance to go to the hospital, let's see if we can have, if we can talk to her at all. So it was a very organic growth. It started as one thing, but I think that's the beauty about documentary. You just go out there and you start listening to people and listen to their stories, and that's how everything started. We met Thule that day when we were there in the hospital, and she just started sharing some of her story, and it was just fascinating. It was fascinating. It was heartbreaking, but there was a lot of hope. And I think that the way in which the hospital, the community partners, and everyone else just rallied around this family was unbelievable. And of course, it actually became big news when it first started because of the Miss Luciana Lira, the elementary school teacher that came to the rescue. And she pretty much helped the family so much that it was just unbelievable. From different angles, the story was just unheard of.
Yeah. And, you know, I think about essential workers, those healthcare workers, and then your essential work, too, with creating this piece of art, which is also telling the truth and showing us. I mean, it's very inspiring to sort of see the community and to see how sick these people are as well. So let's, for people who haven't been able to watch a screener like I have, tell us a little bit about Zuli. And, you know, she's in a coma. She's pregnant. She's COVID-19 positive. We don't know if she's going to live in the beginning of our time with her. But as the story goes on, she's able to tell what her experience is like, not only from being ill, but the trauma that she experiences from the time of, you know, the almost hallucinations that she has. I don't know what the right word is to use there, but the things that she sees while she is being treated. There's a lot happening for this woman, and she tells us herself how she feels. Tell us a little bit about her and the things that you heard from her about what this journey was like.
So Sudi was around 8 months pregnant when she began to cough and wheeze. She was actually having a regular checkup appointment at a local clinic here, and it was a nurse there that said, you know what, you need to go to the hospital. She didn't want to go to the hospital. Everyone was so scared. You know, you don't want to go to the hospital during the peak of the pandemic because you don't know what's going to happen. But she could hardly breathe. Thule, Marvin, the husband, and 7-year-old Junior, they said, you know what? There's no choice. She has to go to the hospital because they send the ambulance. She goes to the hospital. And then, you know, it comes all this hospitalization part, the COVID-19 diagnosis. And the problem was that the baby's oxygen level were getting really, really low. So she had to deliver weeks early. It was a moment of crisis. So before she was ready to give birth, she had to be intubated to have an emergency C-section. So they allow her to call someone. And out of everyone in the world that she could have called, she called the elementary school teacher, Miss Luciana Lira. And she said, please take care of my son, my husband, and my baby. You know, and when I was talking to Ms. Lear, she said, I thought it was a prank, you know, because you would hear a very raspy voice. We're talking about a person who can hardly breathe. Imagine you receiving that phone call and someone telling you, this is me. I know you don't know me that well, but I need you to do this for me. You know what I'm saying? It was a very dramatic moment for Ms. Lear. And for a woman like that, she said, I'm going to do the best that I can, so don't worry about anything. That on its own, it's huge. You know, it tells you about the commitment of our teachers and how they go out of their way to make sure that their families are okay.
Yeah, and Miss Lira talks about her husband and the American dream, and she talks about immigrants who come here, and she's driven by her compassion. It's a very emotional journey for her throughout as well, and she's an advocate for Zuli and her family. But tell us a little bit about how Miss Lira sort of says, you know, this is what we do and this is why, because this is one step on a long journey of people, you know, coming from, in this case, Guatemala, coming from around the world to become Americans and to find this place and to change the place that they have come to. She speaks so eloquently about that because of her own experience.
She's a very smart woman, and I think she's right about that. You know, she's from Brazil, Sylvie's from Guatemala, I'm from Mexico, Catalina from Building One Community is from Colombia. We're all immigrants, you know, and everyone is an immigrant at some point in their family. This is what we have to do. We have to be there for each other. We have to be there for not just for us, but for our community as well. And I think that this story is a good case study of how things can work out. At that moment, I don't think that Miss Lira was thinking, oh, she's from Guatemala, I'm going to help her. I think she would have helped the person regardless of where they were coming from, you know? And I think that's the beauty about this, that you forget about where you're coming from, who you are. There's a need. That's one of the great things about a moment of crisis like the one that we're still living, to be honest. I think it reveals the worst, but also the best in us. And I think this story is refreshing in a way, because it tells you that it's possible to work as one people, because we're one people, and the result can be very, very positive.
And this effort, this community-wide effort, goes beyond Miss Lira. There are people who in Stanford are, you know, figuring out food and diapers and formula, and not just for this family, but for others who have been impacted. And I also want to ask you about the people in the hospital and just their devotion and dedication that we really get to hear. But first, this community who outside the healthcare setting is saying, these people, you know, Marvin's lost his job at this point. We all have to pull together. And they're surprised by, you know, the urgency and the need, but they rise to the occasion. What drives that sense of community, especially during a time when it would be very easy to be... It's a self-preserve and, you know,
of course,
stay at home, stay behind closed doors, keep all your money just in case you're next. And yet we see this huge generosity. Tell me about that.
Jeez, I think that's a great question. And I wish I had like the full answer. So I'm going to give you what I think, you know, because I think it goes even beyond that. And I keep asking myself the same question. It's a time where nobody should be out. Everyone should be more self-protecting. And you see this generosity in people. You see I'm completely biased because my wife is a critical care nurse, so I know what she does. You know, and I know the beautiful work that she's doing and how she was working nonstop, even more than usual during the peak of the pandemic. And you have a hospital that is helping out, no questions asked. You're here. We're going to save your life. I was talking to Dr. Bernstein and Nurse Erica in the film, if you see there. I was asking them a lot of questions about what was going on here at that moment. And Nurse Erica, she said, you know what? I took care of her for one night because she was there for almost a month. You know, can you imagine being there for almost a month? Like she pretty much, almost everyone in the hospital knew who she was. And so many people helped out. I had the chance to talk to some of the people that were involved, but there were so many people involved there. And she received this experimental treatment, as Dr. Bernstein pointed out. And I asked Dr. Bernstein, I said, what do you think saved her life? You think it was the experimental treatment? And he said, you know, we like to think that the treatment helps. We as doctors, we do something. But it's really the nurses, the people that are on the bedside, giving you all that care that you need so bad, what really pulls it through. Nurse Erica was telling me she was in a coma for 18 days. That's a lot. And Nurse Erica said, you know what? To maintain her dignity, we would talk to her all the time. We'd say, we're about to do this or that. Miss Lear was very insistent. She said, I know that she can see it, but can we do a video conference so she can see her baby? And, you know, those moments were very were heartbreaking because you know what's going on and you have this group of people surrounding you being so generous. And having the infrastructure like a hospital backing you up, I think that they consider themselves very, very lucky in what happened. In the film, I asked Julie a question, what do you think would have happened if this happened to you in Guatemala? You know, and she said, I think I would have probably died. We don't have the resources. We don't have this type of, maybe there's a support,
but there's just a different infrastructure. So I think he's very aware that their story is really a miracle, and that who made that possible? It was the hospital saving her life and her baby's life, Miss Lyra being completely selfless and being so generous. Miss Lyra thought she was going to take care of the baby for 2 or 3 days, and she ended up keeping the baby for 5.5 weeks. She didn't know his mom was going to make it. Nobody knew his mom was going to make it. Nobody knew what was going to happen after the discharge. What was going to happen with the baby? Now we know that, you know, babies are not that affected by COVID. But nobody knew that at that time. So that's the reality. You're going through something and you don't think twice. You say, I'm going to do it. I'm going to help it. The community partners, Building One Community, Tiny Miracles, different organizations that said, you know what? Let's help you out. We're going to help you with rent. We're going to bring food. The community at large, people donating. Miss Lyra started a GoFundMe thing that was so successful. I think that they were able to raise like more than $50,000. And that just tells you that people, they said, you know what? They're part of us. They're one of us. So we're going to help them. So I think that was beautiful. You know, and Miss Lyra was there so fast. She said, people that you would never think of, they were donating. And she was receiving messages saying, hey, you know what you're doing is amazing. Here you go. So that's why I think, and we think that this is really a case study of something that can happen and ideally should happen.
Oscar, thank you so much for this this beautiful work that you have put into the world, and thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Frontline producer Oscar Guerra with Lori Walsh, host of In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Frontline airs tonight at 9 Central on Prairie Public's television service. Dakota Datebook is next.
A lot of high school students will be applying to college without standardized test scores this year, which is forcing schools to evaluate candidates in a new way.
You know, we're careening down a very different path of the mountain than we're not used to, at the same time that the ground is still shifting underneath us.
How the pandemic is changing college admissions on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
When you take that social distancing walk or do chores around the house, I mean, you've got plenty of time for that, right? Put on your earbuds and immerse yourself in public radio content made just for you.
Hey, y'all, it's Sam Sanders, and welcome to NPR One.
Hourly newscasts from NPR and Prairie Public, your favorite podcasts, and your new favorite podcast. Plus, stories from Planet Money and Hidden Brain, coverage of the arts, and something we really need to be paying attention to these days, health and science. NPR One is personalized public radio content tailored to your interests, but you'll also hear up-to-the-minute news you need to know, like on the coronavirus.
That personalized balance is the heart and soul of NPR One.
It's just like the radio, but under your control. Download the NPR One app and listen.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 11th. On this date in 1916, it was announced that North Dakota would help supply the dining cars of the Northern Pacific Railroad. A Montpelier farmer secured a contract to provide cucumbers and muskmelons, and North Dakota would also supply snapping turtles. 1,000 pounds of turtles had shipped from Jamestown. The snapping turtle is an ancient species. Turtles appeared more than 200 million years ago. The snapping turtle is the largest turtle in North Dakota. They can live to be 40 years old. They leave the water in late spring and early summer to find a suitable nesting site. They sometimes take advantage of an abandoned muskrat hut or beaver lodge. It's become increasingly difficult for the turtles to avoid humans. They sometimes build their nest in gravel areas like roads or railroad grades. Nesting is a dangerous time for female turtles. They like to build their nest at dusk and dawn when they are hardest to see. Consequently, the search for a nesting site makes it more likely that they can be hit by a car when crossing a road. The female turtle digs a hole, lays her eggs, and packs the dirt on top. She then returns to the water. Once the eggs hatch, the baby turtles are on their own. They dig out of the nest and instinctively seek water. They are vulnerable to predators like coyotes, snakes, and birds. And they can even drown because they are not yet good swimmers. If they survive to the age of 2, then they are very likely to reach adulthood and mate around the ripe old age of 15. Snapping turtles have a reputation for being aggressive and dangerous. They do not have teeth, but their jaws are very strong. They can break a person's finger. If they are in the water, they will swim away from a threat. But on land, they will warn off an attack by stretching out their long necks while hissing and snapping. The North Dakota Department of Game and Fish considers snapping turtles an important component in the balance of the state's environment. The turtles have been found in 43 of North Dakota's 53 counties. The department is conducting an extensive study to determine how best to manage this valuable species. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Look at the right way to visit Fiji.
Fiji's waters are really rich in marine life, and they are protected.
The wisdom of the world's great thinkers.
How can I lead a better, more meaningful life? That is the essence of philosophy, I think.
And what to expect in a pandemic.
So I've been grateful to this moment for opening my eyes to what is really always around us.
It's on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, so after the broadcast, you can always find any Main Street program right there, prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, Stephen Peterson is the Libertarian candidate for the House of Representatives. He'll be our first guest for conversations with the statewide candidates for this fall's election. And family-centered engagement meetings help keep North Dakota parents and children together, reducing the need for foster care. We'll discuss the initiative with the Department of Human Services, Tracy Miller. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.